Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for our program, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls for this hour. Most of Africa's farmers are so poor they cannot grow enough to feed their families year-round. But in January of last year, 2011, a group of Kenyan farmers decided to take a chance joining the One Acre Fund. This is a social enterprise that was set up to try to help some of Africa's most neglected people. The hope was that they could feed their families for the entire year and have a bit left over to sell. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll get the story as we talk with Roger Thoreau. He is Senior Fellow for the Global Agriculture and Food Policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. For 30 years, he was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he is the co-author of another book that deals with a similar theme. That book is titled Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. He is the author of a new book, which is entitled The Last Hunger Season, A Year in an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change. It's recently been published by Public Affairs, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us talking about it. Questions here are welcome, as always. The number in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Any place else, if it's a long-distance call, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. We do also have email. You can send a question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you can certainly give us a call. And Mr. Thoreau, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show. I greatly appreciate it. And
we just start out, and I'm sure that you start out with this idea a lot, and it's I'm sure also the kind of thing, one of the things that just people, it just leaves people scratching their heads. But that is that if you look at chronic hunger around the world and you look at who are the people that are most affected by chronic hunger, most of them are farmers. And that's the place to start. And people are going to say, you mean we're not just talking about, yeah, they don't have enough leftovers they can sell. You mean they can't even subsist on farming?
Absolutely. It's perhaps, I guess, the most confounding, troubling phrase in Africa. Hungry farmers. I mean, it ought to be an oxymoron, because you think, well, how can farmers who rise every morning to grow food be hungry? But that phrase is tragically one of the continent's saddest truisms, that Africa's smallest, or that are smallholder farmers, the people who grow their own food, are also Africa's hungriest people. And that happens because they're, as I said, smallholder farmers, so they're maybe growing food on a half acre, an acre and a half, maybe two acres at the most. And from that, they're feeding their family. Hopefully they have a little surplus that they can sell. But the reality is that in most seasons, just because of a lack of access to the very basic essentials of farming that we all take for granted, access to better quality seeds, to just a little bit of fertilizer, microdosing fertilizer they use, just to common agriculture extension advice and kind of best practice farming methods, and access to credit. Those things have been so rare in most parts of Africa that it does indeed leave most farmers, as I said, who rise every morning to tend to their fields, unable to grow enough food to feed their families throughout the year. And this sets up this period called the hunger season, which is the period that kind of arrives every year. You can almost put it on a calendar. Between the time that the harvest from the previous, the crops from the previous harvest run out to the time that the next harvest comes in. And that is a period that we usually stretch from maybe 1 month or 2 months to can go to as long as 8 or 9 months. And one of the farmers that I profile in the book, her hunger season and for her family stretched on for 9 months.
Wow, that's just really astonishing. And I guess that part of the difficulty here is that the hunger season often involves the place, the time when they're growing the crop that will be the next harvest, and it's also the time that they're actually working the hardest.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another one of the ironies and paradoxes that at the time And again, a cruelty. The time that they're having to work hardest in the fields is the time that the hunger season is biting the harvest. And so what you find is that, and in Western Kenya, the farmers that I follow, their main crop is maize or corn, which they'll grow during the long rains season that, you know, might start in they'll be planting end of March, sometime in March, early April at the latest, hopefully. So in the time after the planting, obviously the maize is growing strong and more robust every day, and the farmers are growing increasingly weaker because during the hunger season is a time when food is rationed during the meals, and that you'll see the meals shrink from three a day to two to one, and then in some days there's nothing except for maybe a cup of tea, sometimes with sugar, sometimes not even sugar. In the morning, and that's kind of it until maybe a cup of tea again in the evening.
Hmm.
So it kind of sets up this kind of horrible period. And for one of the farmers in the book, her hunger season actually began on the day that she planted. Because the farmers kind of, they work in neighborhood groups, these farmers that are associated with the 1 acre fund that you had mentioned. So there's maybe 8 to 12 in a group. And they do that so they can help each other and save on labor costs during the planting, some of the more active times of weeding, and then during the harvest. And so one of the farmers, Leonita, she was keeping aside her last bit of maize that she had to feed the her neighbors and the farmers that were helping her on planting day. And on planting day, then they had their maize and some vegetables after planting, and that was the last of her supplies from the previous harvest.
Yeah.
And so it was this irony that on the day that she plants, her hunger season sets in, and that was the end of March, and then the harvest doesn't come until July or August.
Yeah. And again, I guess I want to reinforce the point, because people have, they're used to hearing about the problem of hunger associated with things like drought or other kinds of natural disaster or conflict, all those things are true. But here what we're talking about is people that they're being as productive as they can, given the fact that they're working a small parcel of land and they're using methods that they have been using for a long time, and that they're hardly cutting edge when it comes to agricultural technology. So it sounds as if given what they have to work with, the people are doing the best that they can. But that's really the issue, that, you know, they're product using those methods on a small plot, that your productivity can only go so far. You can only produce so much. And really, that's the problem.
Absolutely. And that's a really good point to make. They are incredibly hardworking farmers. They're industrious. They're diligent. They're very smart farmers in terms of knowing the conditions of their soil, of being aware of their climate and kind of the signs and realities of nature in their areas. And they are working as hard as possible to grow as much as possible given the conditions that they have. And what they're facing is that in most cases the seed that they have is maybe seed that they're saving from last year's harvest to plant again. When you do that, obviously the germination rates are much lower. Maybe 70% of the plants or the seeds will germinate, as opposed to if you're using new seeds, certainly over 90%. They're not using, if they're using save seed or just a cheaper type of seed that was bred on an open pollinated method, so they're not using hybrid seed, so they don't get that hybrid vigor that comes from it. A lot of times they're planting without fertilizer, and again, the fertilizer, it's remarkable, just kind of the standard dosage that would even be recommended for them to use is the equivalent of, say, a Coca-Cola bottle cap of fertilizer per corn plant. And when they're planting beans, it's a third of a bottle cap per plant or per seed. And so it's very minimal amounts of fertilizer, but they can't even afford that because their access to credit is so little that the banks, you know, don't aren't really into rural areas and providing any services to the farmers. And then when you get just to, as you mentioned, just kind of standard agricultural advice and farming advice, with the 1 acre fund, as they start the year in January when they're getting their fields ready and they're making their preparations to plant, they have an initial training session. It's fascinating to observe. And they go over things such as proper spacing, so 25 centimeters in between the maize plants, 75 centimeters between rows. They make planting string, which is they'll have two sticks, excuse me, and they'll have some twine that they kind of spool around there, and every 25 centimeters they'll put a marker, either a piece of a plastic bag or a bottle cap that they squeeze together that marks every 25 centimeters. They stretch that out along the field, and that's where they dig the hole. And then one of the important things that they're taught then is one seed per hole. And for us, it's like that's kind of just standard knowledge, and any backyard gardener should know and practice. But there, how they usually would practice is they may, you know, scatter their seed like they're feeding chickens or throwing dice. And if there's a couple of seeds that land per hole, okay, well, maybe that's a good thing because at least one of them will grow and take root. But the reality is that all the seeds will, and then they'll be competing for whatever soil nutrients there are, for whatever water there is, for the sunlight. They'll crowd each other out, and so they end up stunted. And to then, you know, trust this new advice that is coming to them, one seed per hole, is also this leap of faith that comes. And so it's just when you just look at kind of the essential elements and then the information that's available to them, it's amazing that they're able to produce even what they do.
Hmm. We could talk some more about this organization that you're talking about here, mm-hmm. but what it is they do. But I think I'm thinking about, having now over quite a few years had quite a few conversations about international development and the critique that always has been raised about some of the efforts that have been made is that the problem is that you get people locked into technologies that are not appropriate for them, dependent on inputs that come from outside the country that are very expensive that they can't really afford, and that the kind of help that has been made available to people like the people that we're talking about hasn't always been really very helpful. And it seems that in this particular case, there is this attempt to scale it more appropriate to what it is these folks really need and really can use, so that it does end up being helpful and not ultimately a kind of a burden.
Absolutely. And there have been plenty of instances of development projects gone awry because, as you say, it isn't appropriate technology, or it's just too expensive for the local circumstances. And one of the main reasons a lot of these development efforts fail or struggle is because they don't really ask the people that they are intending to benefit kind of what is appropriate for you, for your situation. What would you actually need? How will this help? I mean, you see wells that are dug in just wrong places where the water table isn't appropriate, like say irrigation things that are put in, and they're good on paper, but then when it breaks, the spare part is like really expensive. It's not available, and it's too complicated to fix. So there's this whole now push that's gaining momentum of appropriate technology, of scaling things to their purposes, and so as it is with like the little microdosing of the fertilizer, the access to seeds that are all local seeds, to kind of say, well, here's some seeds from the United States, you should plant them. You know, for certain vegetables that might be okay, but for something like corn, which really depends on the type of soil, the elevation. So even in a small area of Kenya, say between, you know, within 20 miles from one village to another or something, you'll have different soil conditions, you'll have different elevation, you might have different rainfall levels, and that all needs to then be thought of in terms of what seed is appropriate for them. And then with the financing, that you don't want them to be burdened by having too great of a loan or something to pay back. So this whole effort of microfinancing and microcredit that's been going on for a couple of decades now and is really, you know, making a big difference in some of the poorer places of the world. A lot of that hasn't really gone to the rural areas yet. It's been more in the urban areas. It's been kind of small micro enterprise, small business type of things that it's been geared to help. And now it's starting to move out into the rural areas and to the farmers. So 1 acre fund, it's basically the credit that they supply, or they'll supply the seeds and the fertilizer and the extension advice on a credit. And that's about maybe $45 per half acre of maize. And that's something that the farmers are all seeing that, yes, that is something that they can pay back. And the repayment rates are you know, greater than 95%, 97%, 98% or so.
Let me introduce again the guest for anybody who has just tuned in, Roger Thoreau. He joined the Chicago Council on Global Affairs as a senior fellow for global agriculture and food policy back in January of 2010, after having spent some 30 years working as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's the editor and principal contributor to the Council's Global Food for Thought blog. When he worked for the Journal, covered a lot of big stories, including the fall of the Berlin Wall and the change of government in South Africa and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He's the co-author of an earlier book that deals with a similar theme. That book was Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. And his new book, which is just recently out, is The Last Hunger Season, A Year in an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change. It's published by Public Affairs. It's just recently come out, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned some of the work that you'd done when you were a reporter with the Journal, a lot of really big stories. What was it that got you interested in this particular subject, that is the problem of hunger, and got you writing about it?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because it's you know, something that I've thought about a lot. And I think that kind of all my foreign corresponding for the Wall Street Journal, it was 20 years mainly based in Europe and in Africa, a little bit of traveling in Asia, I think has brought me to this point. And it was after, I guess it started after 9/11, and President Bush was speaking, I think, in his first address to Congress and to the nation after that horrible day. And he said something to the effect of that, my fellow Americans, I know you are, a lot of you are thinking the same thing that me and people in my administration are thinking, and that's, why do they hate us so much? Why? Where comes this kind of frustration and this attitude that could lead to such horrible acts of terrorism? And having been a foreign correspondent for a long time, that kind of resonated with me, because I had seen things overseas that were kind of unintended consequences of American policies and American actions. And one in particular that you would see is the impact on smallholder farmers in the developing world, and particularly in the poorest countries, and the impact of, say, global agriculture policies, the policies in the United States and in Europe, be they with subsidies, with kind of the way the food aid is structured. And food aid is great and saves a countless number of lives every year, but it's the matter that it hasn't really been modernized or made more efficient with the times, and kind of the trade of agriculture goods kind of putting the smallholder farmers at a disadvantage. And so that's one of the things, or an unintended consequence of that of say, an American policy and the Farm Bill and other things, that when you're kind of in those areas, you see the impact on, say, the smallholder farmers. And that breeds a lot of you know, frustration and discontent. Rarely does it then get to the realm of such extreme acts of violence. But in terms of just asking the question, well, why is this attitude towards the richer part of the world, and kind of where does that come from? And so that's what we deal with a lot in Enough. But it was writing those stories on for the Wall Street Journal, trying to explain this and some of these where you know, kind of some of these attitudes may come from in the developing world, Street Journal. In that time in 2003, there was the famine in Ethiopia, and 14 million people were on the doorstep of starvation during that famine. And so I had been writing about the impact of say, the agriculture policies in Europe and the United States and the rich world on the smallholder farmers, asking the question, well, how come the Green Revolution, led by the great American Norman Borlaug from a small town in northern Iowa and a plant breeder, you know, why did the Green Revolution, which really made a difference in agricultural productivity in Asia and in Latin America, why did that never come to Africa? And kind of looking at the negligence that had kind of set in also by rich world policymakers and development institutions like the World Bank and things. What happened? And so the famine of Ethiopia in 2003 then for me was kind of a manifestation of kind of this negligence and the unintended consequences, say, of rich world agriculture policy. And so when I went to Ethiopia and the things that I saw there really moved me, I think, as a journalist, as no other story has. And on my first day in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, before I went down to some of the hunger zones, I was speaking with some people from the World Food Program. And they're kind of the United Nations organization that delivers food relief and helps with agriculture development, that they were kind of briefing me, okay, here's what you're going to see. And one of them said, Roger, it was a warning of sorts, an advice, but kind of in the sense of a warning, that Roger, looking into the eyes of someone dying of hunger becomes a disease of the soul, because what you see is that nobody should have to be dying of hunger, particularly not in the 21st century. And in the next day, when I was down in those areas and seeing all the children that were in emergency feeding tents and thinking about what kind of happened with this famine and what was causing it, that I thought, yeah, this is a story. It did indeed become a disease of the soul for me. And just kind of briefly to sum it up, what was happening in Ethiopia in the famine of 2003, that famine followed quickly on the heels of 2 years of great abundance and some of the best years that farmers had had in Ethiopia in the seasons of 2000, 2001, and then 2001 and 2002. What happened was that with their bumper harvest, markets hadn't been developed, infrastructure hadn't been developed to absorb that surplus. So farmers, although they were very successful, when they went to the markets, they were actually losing money. They couldn't cover their expenses of their harvests and of their farming efforts. And there were farmers, some larger commercial farmers that had the best crops of their lives, and lost $250,000. Smallholder farmers were taking their surplus crops that they may have had for the first time in years to the market, and what they were getting was less than their cost of operations, because there wasn't any mechanism set up to absorb this harvest. Prices collapsed more than 80%. Farmer incentive drained for the next year. They knew less was going to be planted for 2003. And then a drought hit. And so it was the markets that failed before the weather did. And so as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, looking at that market impact, looking at the negligence of accompanying the greater effort to produce more food after other famines in Ethiopia, the emphasis to produce, but there had nobody been paying attention to kind of the infrastructure, the markets, the getting it to the markets, to the middlemen, to exports, so that the farmers could reap some incentive from their work. And so looking at that, I figured, no, that becomes more than just a story of drought or natural disaster. There was also kind of man-made consequence in that. And that then is a story that I figured that's what I need to concentrate on as a journalist. I'm, as I said, really infected by this disease of the soul, and decided that's the one story that I need to really concentrate on as a journalist.
Well, I'd like to have you talk some more about the One Acre Fund and mm-hmm. and what it is. And it seems that perhaps one of the reasons that it has been as effective as it has, and for people who have worked with it, they actually have seen really significant increases in their yields. It seems that one of the things that One Acre is really trying to do is to to address the whole picture, to try to get at all of those things, not only helping people increase their yields, but do it in a way that's sustainable and appropriate, and also address, at least trying to address, some of these infrastructure issues that come into play once you've actually managed to get the crop produced.
Yep, absolutely, and what you say is so important, and that's something that 1 acre, being aware of how things have developed on the agriculture front in Africa or had not developed. Figuring that, you have to look at all these aspects, and other organizations are beginning to do that as well. Say the Gates Foundation, Howard Buffett, also in Central Illinois, what Howard's Foundation is doing. On this front, it kind of looks at the needs, particularly of smallholder farmers, all the way from the time that they're preparing to plant to once the harvest is in, and storage issues and to have markets available is so critical. And because it's all one of the whole piece. You might succeed on production and have great increases in harvest, and hooray for that, but then you kind of lose the farmer incentive to keep going if the rewards aren't there in the market, or the infrastructure is just so screwed up, or the storage is so bad that it's routine in Africa that farmers 30% of their harvest or 40% will routinely go to waste just because of kind of medieval type storage facilities. So they're spoiled by the weather, by pests, by rodents and the insects and things. And so what the 1 acre fund had particularly concentrated on and focused on is this kind of distribution gap. That what is the difference between smallholder farmers who may be more successful and those that aren't? And they decided, and Andrew Yoon, the founder who had been in the Kellogg School and the MBA program at the Kellogg School at Northwestern, that it was what seemed to be the differentiating point between a successful farmer and one that is less successful and struggling to feed their family and kids dying of malnutrition, is this matter of access to the essential elements of farming, the access to better quality seed, the access to this little bit of fertilizer, this access to extension advice and to credit to be able to pay for all of that. They don't give anything away because that, when you're talking about development efforts in the past that have failed, relying too much on things that are given away, and that's not sustainable because that requires a funding mechanism that has to be in perpetual motion, and a lot of times that would dwindle up or something happens. So there has to be this kind of credit system involved. So that's what 1 acre identified, and then working on vital on the storage issue, that the longer the farmer can store his maize, or her maize, most of the farmers are women, the smallholder farmers, the longer they can store their maize, the better price they'll get, because the price is low after the harvest, there's a surplus in the markets, and then as you kind of, the further you get away from that, the more, the higher the price is. So storage becomes absolutely critical, and then access and the infrastructure to get to the markets. And so you're seeing more and more people looking at that, and I think the 1 acre fund is very much on the cutting edge of those efforts.
We're talking this morning in this hour with Roger Thoreau. We're talking about some of what you'll find in his new book. It's titled The Last Hunger Season. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com or 217-333-6280.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. We're here Monday through Friday with two different topics for you each morning from 10 until noon. Tomorrow morning, something of a practical nature. Our guest will be Phil Nixon. He's an extension specialist who deals with insect problems. So if you have a bug problem in your house or in your garden, we can help with that. In the second hour tomorrow, you will be hearing an interview that I recorded a few weeks back with Cokie Roberts. She's an award-winning journalist for both National Public Radio and ABC News. We talked when she was here visiting the campus to be the commencement speaker for this year, and it was just right before Mother's Day, so we spent a good bit of our time talking about women in politics, something that she's very interested in, some of her own background. Her mom, actually both of her parents, were in Congress, so we talked about that and some of her experience as a journalist, how she became a journalist, balancing work and family, all that. You can hear that in a conversation that we recorded when she was here. So we won't be taking any calls the second hour tomorrow. That's what we'll do for tomorrow. You can find the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can find out what we'll do in the days ahead. You can follow us on Twitter at WILL Public Media. You can also check us out on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Roger Thoreau. He's with the Council, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's a senior fellow for global agriculture and food policy, has been associated with the council since the beginning of 2010. That after having spent quite a few years working for the Wall Street Journal. In fact, for 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent for the paper based in Europe and Africa, covered a lot of big stories. He is the co-author of the book Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty, and also this new book that we're talking about here this morning. The title is The Last Hunger Season, the subtitle A Year in an African Farm Community on the Brink of Change in Public Affairs, is the publisher of the book. Questions are certainly welcome. Folks want to call in. Questions, comments, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free. So anywhere that you might be listening, it's good for you. That number, it's 800-222-9455. And email is also a possibility if you'd like to send in your question or comment by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Perhaps you can just talk a little bit more specifically about this this part of Kenya, where you went and spent this time with people, talking to them, watching them, and just following them through the agricultural year.
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. I kind of settled on Western Kenya because they're planting season is within the calendar year, so I figured that was kind of meter for kind of the narrative thread of the book and following them. I made I think six or seven trips back and forth during the year at the critical times of the growing season, and spent several weeks each time, and wanted to present this rather intimate portrait of their lives and trying to understand them. Also, Western Kenya is a Kenya English-speaking country. Western Kenya, interesting that it's one of the kind of breadbaskets of Kenya and East Africa, but paradoxical in the sense that because there are so many smallholder farmers, the total agriculture production is one of the highest in Kenya. From the Western Kenya area, but the amount of the percentage of individual malnutrition and poverty is the highest, and that's kind of also paradoxical. But when you think it's so many smallholder farmers in aggregate, they're producing a lot, but individually and for the families, not enough that as we say leads them to this hunger season every part of the year. And also why I wanted to kind of focus on the smallholder farmers and the ones in Kenya, very typical. Oh, there was also that where President Obama comes from is also Western Kenya. It's maybe about a two-hour drive from where these farmers, so I figured, okay, there's that resonance as part of it, too. And I spent a part, there's several pages in the book where I'm spending some time with his step-grandmother. Who's still living there, but what I wanted to kind of focus on these smallholder farmers is to try to have readers have this kind of appreciation or understanding of their lives, but then also their importance to us, because the great challenge that we're facing in this world, and something that all of us, whether the farmers in Africa or here in the United, all of us in the United States or anywhere in the world, is that by the year 2050, we basically need to nearly double food production in the world to meet the demands of a population that is growing in both size and in prosperity. So as people in formerly hungry places like China and India and other parts of Asia and Latin America, as they move into the middle class, they're eating more. They're eating differently. That puts an additional strain on the global food chain. In addition to, between now and 2050, we'll be adding another 2.5 billion people or so. That's the equivalent of adding like another two Chinas to the world in terms of population growth. And a lot of that's going to come in the developing world and in Africa. And so this task of doubling food production, when you look at where can that quantum leap come from, where can that increase come from, one of the places that is poised to have the greatest jump in agricultural productivity is Africa, and particularly the smallholder farmers of Africa, because they are so far behind because of this neglect that we were talking about, the neglect of their own governments, the rich world governments, the great development institutions, not really concentrating on smallholder agriculture development, that they're in this position of being able to have these greatest leaps in production. And there's, you know, anywhere between 30, 40, 50 million of these farmers in Africa alone. And their yields are maybe a fifth or a tenth, depending on the crop, of yields of farmers in the richer parts of the world and in the United States. And what one sees, and certainly what the One Acre Fund is finding, that within just one season of having this access to these essential elements of farming, of this extension advice, they can double, triple, or quadruple their harvest in one season. Now it's a question of that being sustainable and doing it year after year after year. And then you can really see that kind of the agriculture potential and promise of these farmers being realized. And what a great thing it is and will be that not only can they feed their families and their communities, but that they can also contribute to kind of this global food supply by Africa being able to feed itself.
You know, I realize that I'm about to ask a question that's really a different sort of question, but I guess I'm interested in having you reflect on it and what people might be saying about it. And it goes something like this. You know, here in the United States, probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, demographic changes that took place over the course of the 20th century was the movement of people from rural to urban, and that was made possible by mechanization and new agricultural technologies that made it possible for farms to be bigger and more productive and for that to happen with fewer people working. You didn't need to have as many people working the farm. So the farms got bigger, the farm families got smaller, at least they took fewer people to work the farm. And I wonder whether looking at this, a place like Kenya, for example, where there are a lot of very small holder farms, whether people are saying, well, maybe there should be some sort of deliberate movement in the same direction, make farms bigger, make them more productive. But then I suppose that means then people are going to have to go someplace else and do right. Something else. Is that something that people talk about?
It is. And so the urbanization, the move to the city is kind of happening across Africa, you know, kind of irregardless of, you know, of you know, greater mechanization or greater productivity on the farmers. And that's not really, you know, happening yet. It's beginning to happen on the farm. But the urbanization happening, and that's mainly a lot driven by just the despair on the farms and the poverty and this hunger season. And if people can escape that and go to the cities where there will at least be more food available, it's a matter then of affordability, there'd be more jobs, particularly in the informal sector, that would be available, educational opportunities, perhaps better in the city. So you see that movement, you know, kind of happening anywhere. And I think what they're looking at in Africa is and people I've talked to that are heads of state, that are kind of the Pan-African organizations that are involved in agriculture, one of the points they make is that the more successful that the smallholder farmers can be, that's a greater incentive for the people to stay on the farms and in the rural areas, particularly if the kids can see, oh, this life isn't so hard as it is now for my parents. I can really make an impact here by perhaps being an extension officer, by working for an organization like the One Acre Fund, which, you know, the vast 90-95% of their people that work for the One Acre Fund are Kenyans and are farmers themselves. And the need then to stay in the rural area to provide medical and health assistance and pharmaceutical things and just provide services. And as those areas and the farmers become more prosperous, then kind of the shops and things that would and the markets and things and the mercantile aspect, that would all pick up. And so what they're thinking is that, yeah, that might be a way for people to kind of stay in the rural areas, relieve some of the pressure on the cities. But then the other point that you're raising, which is also a really good one, is in order for them to be really effective and increase their agriculture, does this have to be this kind of growing or larger farms in rural Africa? And you'll find some of that happening, but on a smallholder basis, that it'll be one smallholder farmer who maybe has an acre or an acre and a half. There'll be another farmer who maybe wants to move to the city or who's older and the kids have moved away and they're not able to farm so much, that they will then want to expand to have 2 acres or 3 acres. And so you kind of see those aspirations already setting in. But it's just kind of the nature of the land holdings there, of agriculture, of the lack of mechanization as there is now, kind of the lack of infrastructure for the roads, for water and things, that kind of that move to bigger farms, if that is to happen, that's still quite a ways in the future. And then there's debates of whether that is a good thing to happen, as certainly has been the debate in the United States, that is that actually a good thing, and what does that mean for family farms? What is it meant for family farms in the United States? What could it mean in the future for the smallholder farmers in Africa? And that's something that really people really need to pay attention to, and at this moment is kind of unknown. Well, how will that play out? But it is something, as you say, that people are indeed talking about and thinking about, and I think that's really good that there is kind of this vigilance and there this awareness of the social dynamics and what happens, you know, as agriculture becomes more productive.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation here, and we have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus with Roger Thoreau. And the questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with. They're in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a few questions. What about in terms of, is there a crop rotation of some sort, or because you mentioned maize, is that, you know, we get stuck in our culture with, you know, corn.
Right.
And then the next step is pesticides, herbicides, and all this other stuff, you know, big farms.
Right.
In terms of a comment on this?
Yeah, a really good question. And I think that's also something that then comes in through the extension advice from organizations like One Acre Fund and the advice and the extension services that they're able to provide. The farmers now realize the value of crop rotation for the health and vitality of their soils, and that there are some crops that then will, the beans and others, that then will kind of replenish the nitrogen, say, that the maize, that the corn is taking out, that the corn is like the rainy season crop, and that if they grow enough, it's one, the staple crop, so it's one that the people are just most familiar with eating, and then becomes their kind of cash crop in a sense. But realizing that in the second season, when the shorter rains are there, and after the harvest, now there's a much more greater emphasis on planting these other crops of vegetables, be they you know, some kind of beans or groundnuts, peanuts, peas, pumpkins, tomatoes, bananas. Some will be planting trees. Some perhaps napier grass for the dairy cows. And they find that crop rotation is important on several fronts. One on just something different for the soil and replenishing soil. Two, for the nutritional value of the family and for the family diet. So it's not just a reliance on maize and kind of the starchy foods and things. It could also be having potatoes and sweet potatoes. And then also for that it varies their income. So they're not so dependent on whatever income they may derive from their maize if they have a surplus. But they have these other crops that are coming in at different times of the year. So you find a lot of intercropping. So as the maize starts coming up, then they'll also plant beans. Really good question on the crop rotation, that they're becoming more vigilant and much more of that happening.
Yeah, the comment here, at least, what happens is it keeps people in the rural area. The problem here is that, there is a counter trend in terms of organic farming and local, that kind of thing, trying to build a community. The last concern is that, I guess China and probably some other countries have been buying land there and turning it into vast, big-time farming. So any comment, and then I'll just, sign off here and let you talk, okay?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's also a really good question. And so one is starting to see that trend. It's kind of at the beginning, so we don't kind of really know. You can see in certain instances what kind of the end of motivation and rationale of, say, China, India, South Korea, some of the Middle East, Arab countries that have their own constraints on food production, either because of population, because of land availability, or just kind of in the Arab countries that, they're in situations where they don't have much agriculture, arable land. And so they're increasingly looking to Africa. And you're right, in some countries there have been fairly bigger land sales called land grabs by some. And that is also what has to be really vigilant of that it doesn't become a new kind of a new wave of colonialism or something. In the past, you had other people coming into Africa for extractive industries, be it the precious metals or the timber or the rubber or something, or the gold or the diamonds. This is people that are coming into Africa for the soil, for the sun, for the rain, for the available land, and vigilance needs to be taken on that the smallholder, that this doesn't happen to the detriment of the smallholder farmers, that they're pushed out of areas because there's bigger land concessions that are being granted. And if they come in and there are these bigger agriculture developments, yeah, whatever they do on an infrastructure front of say new roads, of an irrigation system, that better markets, that all becomes also available to the smallholder farmers, that they are able to benefit by whatever kind of commercial development of farming there would be. So I think there's both some opportunity there, but there's also some potential peril that one's starting to see and that may happen and that one really needs to be vigilant about. So yeah. Great question.
We're coming down to a couple of minutes here. And again, I guess I would suggest if people, by the way, are interested in finding more about the One Acre Fund, they do have a website, and it is a non-governmental organization that works with small farmers in East Africa. As Roger explained, was founded by a guy who got his MBA at Northwestern University and has been doing this now for a while, and providing some inputs, seeds, fertilizer, some technical expertise, some extension advice, trying to help people, just simply people who are small holders, increase their yields, and has been quite successful. So if people want to find out more about One Acre, they can read up on it. I guess my question here is a way of finishing up is what you think might be the future of larger national efforts. The United States, for example, and other countries do spend money on foreign aid, not as much as most people think, but they do. So maybe the question is, has it been not enough? Has it been poorly targeted? Would it make more sense if that kind of work was left to NGOs?
That's also a great question. I think at this stage, as President Obama said, I think it was last Friday or a week ago Friday at a symposium in Washington, Chicago Council hosted before the G8 meeting, where the G8 leaders talked about this. And the president said we actually need a all hands on deck effort on this. Both the governments of Africa and the developing nations, their governments need to get involved in prioritizing Africa, coming up with their own programs and their own national plans of here's what we're going to do to revitalize and transform our agriculture, and particularly for the benefit of the smallholder farmers. It takes the involvement then of the donor nations, the richer countries, to kind of say, what are you doing on the ground? How can we support your efforts and your plans that you are doing, as opposed to us in the rich world saying, oh, here's what you ought to do, but take the lead from those countries themselves and what they're doing on that front. Corporations to get involved to really look at this, because the ag industry and the private sector in particular has also been part of this neglect and hasn't really gone out to the rural areas. They've seen the smallholder farmers as too poor, too remote, too insignificant for their products and their services, even though most of the farmers have cell phones. The Coke and Pepsi and the soft drinks are out there, and other products. There hasn't been this push by the private sector, and then also the NGOs that you mentioned and the foundations to do a lot of the work and have a presence on the ground, and the whole scalability issue that you mentioned and the work of the 1 Acre Fund. That in 2006 when they started, they were working with 40 farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're past 130,000 farmers, mm-hmm. and they're up to 135,000 in Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, and elsewhere. So they've had this remarkable scaling up, and their plans are to continue to do that. And so one needs to be ambitious on this front, that they're not efforts just to help this village or this region of a country, but to do it on an ambitious national level. So your question on the leadership from the national governments and the intentions, and then on foreign aid, it's a remarkable statistic that 25% of all American aid to the developing world in the early 80s, a quarter of that went to agriculture. In the last couple of years, it was down to 1% went to agriculture. So agriculture was basically downgraded in this era of kind of negligence that we describe in the book enough, that is now starting to be reversed. And President Obama, with his Feed the Future program, an initiative that he has that is there to support kind of these national programs, what there is this new alliance for agriculture and food security that they've adopted in the G8, efforts that foundations and some of the institutions are doing, they're all kind of wanting to reverse this neglect and to focus, as you said rightly, the little bit of the budget that goes to foreign aid, to reorient that towards agriculture as it had been back in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
We're going to have to stop there. The book is The Last Hunger Season by our guest, Roger Thoreau. He's a senior fellow for global ag and food policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it. Great discussion.
All right.